Thank you for listening to Overleveraged, where we explore the big macro themes affecting investors, economic imbalances, giant geopolitical trends, tail risks and tremors, and everywhere risks are not being fully priced into markets. Remember, trading carries risk, and all opinions are provided as general market commentary only. Please do your own research. Our risk warning will follow at the end. Hello, and welcome to Overleveraged. And joining me once again is John Heumann from Vox Markets.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for having us on.
And the topic today is, well, it's sort of a bit of a roundabout look at some emerging markets, or what we still perhaps anachronistically call emerging markets. Specifically China and India. And in terms of China, I wanted to discuss the sort of Japanification with China, because there are some incredible parallels that are being drawn. I think maybe in some cases it's accurate, in some cases maybe less accurate, but the parallels between where China is at in an economic sense today compared with where Japan was in the late 80s. You've got this massive property bubble that's burst, and then there's some longer term sort of structural things, you know, the demographics of population change and so on, and you know, a lot of people are looking at China and Japan in this way. India, though, is another story.
Different beast, very different beast.
So where should we start? Is it worth looking at Japan in the first case?
Yeah, because that sort of, you know, history gives you a guide as to where China's future may lie. I mean, they're very different countries, you know, very different cultures. But as you say, there are some interesting parallels in property and you know, demography in particular.
Yeah. I mean, the real estate boom in Japan, it's gone in the history books. It's one of the all time. I think there's this there's a great factoid. The grounds of the Imperial Palace in Tokyo were once estimated to be worth more than all the land in California at the peak of the bubble. So that's sort of tulip level. That's, you know, tulip bulbs changing hands for millions of guilders or whatever it was.
It's that sort of level.
And yet, maybe China's is maybe even more extreme.
China's property, you know, bubble and bursting of that bubble, it's been slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, residential construction peaked at around 20% of GDP in China, which is three times what it was in Japan. Chinese real estate looks even more overvalued. That's according to Reuters. At the end of last year, China accounted for just over a quarter of the world's total real estate, according to Savills. So there's some massive numbers, massive amount of building that's been going on, and the sort of collapse of that bubble, the pricking of the bubble has left a lot of bad debts, a lot of bad loans and stranded assets.
It's taken a few years to really unravel. So the you know, see the Evergrande story, that really started to
So just
about sort of 3 years ago.
So Evergrande, just for the listeners, can you explain just brief sort of synopsis?
Yeah. Very large residential property group. Essentially, there were signs of, you know, distress in that company sort of three years ago. You know, fears of collapse. You know, the government really did everything it could to fend off a collapse, because, you know, I guess with, you know, not just to prevent the collapse of Evergrande itself, to prevent contagion throughout the residential construction market, which, as you say, was, you know, a very big chunk of the Chinese economy. Lots of retail, you know, sort of domestic investors in that property market as well. Speculative. You know, a lot of stuff was built, you know, off plan. A lot of property was sold that you know, at the time didn't exist and was never delivered. So, you know, you essentially had a lot of angry house buyers.
Very
angry.
Daily Mail readers.
Yeah, well,
maybe,
you know.
No, I shouldn't say that.
But yeah, no, it's been a very slow motion car crash.
And it's still unraveling. I think I'm trying to find a quote here. So Capital Economics out with a note at the beginning of March: unavoidable structural decline in the property sector in China. So it's still ongoing. The worst is to come. And the real economic impact on the rest of society is still to be felt.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I mean, it's like the UK. Property is a very important investment class, you know, for a lot of people. Investments where people live, but it's almost considered an investment. And I think the same has been true in China. So, you know, as property prices plummet, which they haven't in the UK, obviously. But you know, as they fluctuate in the UK, that wealth effect does have an impact on
the
wider economy.
Well, we're not building, are we?
No.
China's built a lot.
Yeah.
But we haven't really built anything. So.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, the problem is that you know, declining property prices, you know, a real, as you say, sort of structural collapse of the Chinese residential property market creates a real impact on the feel-good, the wealth feel-good factor in the country. So that will impact, you know, consumption. And obviously China is an economy where manufacturing has led the way. Mm-hmm. Consumption has really sort of failed to catch up. They've tried to manage this transition from manufacturing to consumption, and it hasn't really happened. And then you've got, you know, chucking a property crisis for good measure, and you know that's going to stop it in its tracks.
Deconsumption. I read something. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's the lack of consumption is the problem, and the savings glut. And I guess we go on to discuss the demographics, the aging population, and what that does, that creates more savers effectively. Just on where we are with China, and that you mentioned the wealth effect. And that was something that, you know, was very much evident in Japan, that sort of illusory wealth effect that left people hanging when it did pop.
Yeah, house prices go up, people feel richer, house prices come down, and all of a sudden, you know, sort of economic foundations of a consumer society are shaken to their core. There's a great piece actually in Bloomberg this week by the historian Niall Ferguson, the financial historian, and he's talking about actually sort of depopulation as a global trend, actually, you know, sort of falling birth rates, and he made a very interesting observation about China, is that, you know, that it's not, they don't have a problem with space in the country, they have a problem with empty flats and how you fill them.
Yeah,
and the answer is, you know, that is a land of ghost estates.
I guess
the closest parallel in the West was what happened in Ireland when you had sort of the pre-financial crisis building boom.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the potato famine.
No. You could say that as well.
That was a massive depopulation.
Depopulation is a big problem for economies. You know, it's something Elon Musk is often talking about. You know, we need people to have children. Now, whether you agree with that or not, you know, it doesn't matter. But actually, if you look at China, a lot of these demographic problems which we're about to talk about do come from a policy that's, you know, goes back some way, the one-child policy.
And that is now producing an effect where there's a shortage of labour. And I think one in five Chinese people are over the age of 60.
Yeah.
OECD, I've got the OECD demographics here. So in 2000, there were 6.5 working age people per retiree, per person of retirement age. In 2020, that has shrunk to 3.6. And then by 2040, they estimate just 1.7. So a huge compression in the number of people that are supporting the elderly population.
Yeah, which is where the comparisons with Japan lie, because obviously that's had that demographic effect much earlier. I think the sort of median working age in Japan is something like 48. In China, it's 38.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Look across at India, which you've alluded to. Mm-hmm. I think the median working age there is 29. And you've got just a much bigger working age population there, which is where the attractions for investors sort of currently lie. But you know, going back to China, mm-hmm. it's only going one way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's only going one way at the moment.
And you know, the lesson from Japan, you know, Japan had this property bubble burst, and then you ended up with deflation for the last 30 years, really.
Yeah,
and now they finally exited deflation, they think, and the Bank of Japan is moving to normalise policy rates and so on. But it's taken a very long time in Japan, and real incomes have not, you know, they've been compressed, and GDP has not grown, and Japan has lost status. And the question, I guess, we're trying to answer is that what maybe is happening with China? You know, it's been this sort of rising force, but has it peaked?
Yeah, right now it looks like, you know, it doesn't know where to turn. And, you know, speaking to an investment trust manager who looks at, you know, invests across the Far East, a guy called Satdura Henderson, you know, his observation was that what China is lacking and what Japan has actually put in place is sort of fundamental reform that addresses these structural problems in sort of society and economy. Japan has, you know, made lots of sort of corporate reforms. It's introduced lots of new things that will potentially change the structure of the workforce, that enable companies to be a lot more sort of governance reforms, sort of workforce employment law reforms. Yeah. So actually, it's those reforms are making Japan a more dynamic economy that it hasn't been for a while. Those reforms are absent in China at the moment.
Yeah, and that's key, and that's maybe down to the political system as much as anything. But yeah, I've got Yashing Huang's The Rise and Fall of the East, who he teaches at MIT Sloan School of Management, warning that the current sort of leadership bureaucratic style is stifling China's economic development, and it's China's rise was built off the back of private enterprise, and that there's been a lot of sort of clampdowns. There's been clampdowns on corruption. He's suggesting that it's not yet, like you said, the reforms there are not going to take place.
No, but they seem to have sort of moved in one direction and then shifted into another. So there was a big push, essentially ostensibly against corruption, but that obviously then sort of brought in a lot of their sort of billionaire class, the sort of Jack Ma's, that kind of technology entrepreneur, which at one stage, that was the exciting story in sort of global markets. And all of a sudden, China's government took aim at that sector, and things like the education sector wanted to take much more sort of command and control approach to things. And it didn't really work. It sent, fear rippling through Chinese markets, and obviously with overseas investors in Chinese markets, and it's sort of looking. It looks like it's sort of reversing a lot of those policies, or certainly softening them. Mm-hmm. It's sort of autocratic governance at a sort of a national government level was what Xi was obviously going for, but that's had disastrous effects.
I guess there are, the similarities with Japan in the 90s, bank-centered financial system, maturing economy, bad demographics, and this bubble deflating, pricking. But China maybe has, resources to sort of counteract some of that.
It does, but it hasn't, you look at the real estate bubble, and you sort of look at a lot of its sort of national champion-led industries, and what you see is sort of a misallocation of capital. And actually, what it's missing now is the ability to having misallocated capital to essentially dump the results of that onto the rest of the world.
And that's going
to this goes to the geopolitics, speaks to the geopolitics of the situation that China has been an integral cog in sort of globalization, particularly Western companies and sort of resource extractors. It's a big market for them. It's a big source of low cost manufacturing. Now with sort of geopolitical concerns, a lot of that manufacturing, not in its entirety, but a lot of manufacturers, Western companies who had really embedded China in their supply chains are looking elsewhere. And that's again where the sort of India story becomes attractive and other sort of, Asian economies like Vietnam, for example.
And so, it's probably worth having a look at India now. I think we've talked a fair bit about China. Mm. I just maybe it's worth just sort of recapping the similarities versus and the differences with Japan. So I've got Goldman Sachs saying, the challenges in China are worse than 1990s Japan. Urban residential property vacancy rate is around 20% in China. So that's what you're talking about, these lack of people.
You can't fill the flats.
Can't fill the flats.
You see videos, the big demolition projects.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy.
Ghost villages or ghost skyscraper villages.
Yeah, and then Citibank, they said asset price corrections and amplification shock via the banking system will likely be milder in China than Japan. China's future growth prospects may be decelerating more sharply.
And I think part of that is essentially sort of a flight of capital.
Well, there's that being
capital investment from China, as say, into other economies.
And the stock market's reflected that. I mean, you've seen a big decline in Chinese stocks for a while now, and really being propped up by the national team that's been coming in, the sort of these state-backed institutions that buy up.
The ETF buyers.
Yeah. So there has been, I think, a 14% rally or something on the CSI 300 since its five-year low in February. But yeah, it's certainly, I think we've mentioned it here before, that anything but China trade, which is boosted Japanese stocks, it's boosted Indian stocks, which are also at a record high. So let's go into India, because I think that's the kind of the other side of the coin, and sheds light on the predicament of China by showing up what the alternative is.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had a great quote written by an economist that I know, which was that China's problem is that it's grown old before it's grown rich.
That's a good quote.
It's a great quote. And I wish I'd have come up with it myself, but I didn't.
Could have passed it off. I don't think anyone would have
noticed. A very, very smart lady called Christine Shields, who used to be a senior risk economist at Standard Chartered.
All right.
Yeah, but India looks very, very different. As we've already said, its population is much younger. Mm-hmm. It's now the biggest country by population in the world.
And its growing population, whereas China's actually now shedding its population. Yes. Now it's in decline.
Yeah. And, does this matter? Does population size matter? It only matters really if you can put the workforce to good effect. Now, both China and India do have a problem with youth unemployment. Mm-hmm. China actually stopped reporting its youth unemployment statistics in the middle of 2023 for 6 months, so it changed the measure because it had just risen and risen and risen, from the pandemic onwards, and it was way above 20%. Now it's about 14.5%. They've sort of stripped out certain students from that, I think mainly. But youth unemployment is a problem. If the workforce is what drives economic growth, and you can't put your young workforce to use, then you've got a bit of a problem. Now India has a high youth unemployment rate as well. But what India doesn't have, it hasn't seen the shift, the migration from rural to urban in the same way that China already has. Mm-hmm. So that's to come. It comes from a much lower base of GDP per capita.
Yeah.
It's already, much more focused on domestic consumption than the manufacturing-led growth. Mm-hmm. And that's even at those low levels of GDP per capita.
Yeah.
So, you kind of, it's almost like the sort of, the fact that you have them at sort of similar levels of youth unemployment today, it's almost a benefit to India because it is that workforce that can be upskilled, which is a sort of key tenet of government policy there. And a lot of Western companies are now looking at India as their manufacturing base, not just their sort of software and IT services base as it used to be. And this is all very much supported by cool China state a stable political system because obviously
stable.
It's communist.
Yes.
India is relatively stable. We've got an election coming up this year. Modi looks like he's getting a third term.
Yeah.
Their sort of policy is very much sort of it's very conservative in respect of government expenditure in relation to China. So yes, they're investing in infrastructure, but they're not doing it at the expense of misallocated capital. And that infrastructure, it's a virtuous circle that then attracts Western companies even more.
I think we talked about mentioned infrastructure in relation to India in a previous episode. But and I think Modi is seen as sort of pro-business. For the markets, Modi's probably going to be positive.
But if you go back somewhere in India, it hasn't been the easiest place for Western companies to do business over the years. It is very closed, both in terms of inward investment into the stock market and sort of certain, large swathes of the economy. But as it opens up, foreign capital flowing in. I think FDI, foreign direct investment, more than doubled in 2021-22. Huge.
That is huge. Yeah. And so, India's not at risk of going the way of Japan anytime soon.
Not looking at the demographics. I mean,
so young. But the thing is even Japan now Japan? Because, they seem to be turning a corner economically. The changes that, we mentioned earlier, there have been significant changes in Japan. And it is now firing on more cylinders than it used to, but it can't shift, I guess, the demographic.
It can't, but it can address them, And in fact, and again, this is something we alluded to before when we spoke about AI. Japan is a world leader in robotics and artificial intelligence, and arguably it's a world leader in robotics and artificial intelligence because it had that demographic problem that it needed to address.
Yeah, but is China going to follow that sort of line of thinking? Do you think? Is it already?
You would think it is already. But how many Chinese factories are still somewhat antiquated? You do have more high tech manufacturing there. Your Foxconns of the world have obviously been there for quite some time, manufacturing or certainly assembling things like the iPhone. Yeah. But if you from the stories we hear from the outside world, like, that's quite labour intensive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have they invested in the kind of, you know, state of the art manufacturing facilities that Japan has that are now actually sort of helping Japan to overcome this demographic, well, whatever the opposite of a dividend is.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other sort of thing to mention, I guess, with China and talking about factories and high tech is tariffs and the prospect of what's coming up later this year with Donald Trump potentially becoming president once again. And he's very much talking up tariffs. And I think even if he weren't to win the presidency, there's a sort of the effect of trade barriers are you know, we're seeing this deglobalization process, which has been happening, shifted really since COVID. That hyper globalization period of the previous 30 years has definitively stopped.
Yeah.
We then saw a period of slowbalization, I think it's called.
Slowbalization.
So, sort of, you know, leveling off of globalization. Now we're in outright sort of deglobalization. And that's presumably not very good for China.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure we are heading as fast down the deglobalization route as has been suggested in some quarters.
Yeah, okay.
I think what you are seeing is it's moving.
Yeah, moving parts.
Moving around.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's more economies that are being brought into that global picture.
Disruption and dislocation.
There's disruption and dislocation for sure.
Yeah.
You know, there is, you know, a trend towards nearshoring, friendshoring. You know, basically trying to find places where you can protect supply chains. Whereas, you know, perhaps historically it was about the cheapest, lowest cost supply chain.
Yeah.
Now there's a bit more management of the risks of that supply chain at top of the executives' minds.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just about the lowest cost, it's about having a supply chain that's resilient.
Yeah.
And that's been a concern around China, that, you know, the zero COVID policies really were massively disruptive for supply chains and forced everyone to essentially look elsewhere, as have, you know, say, the sort of geopolitical issues that did start in the Trump era, but they didn't, you know, Biden and the Democrats didn't really row back.
No, they've not rowed them back. I think there's an acceptance of essentially some sort of Cold War.
It's felt like that. Yeah. It has felt like that for some time. And, you know, what you do see, you know, there was a front page story of the FT, you know, less than a month ago that, you know, the FBI has put out warnings of Chinese cyber attacks, and, you know, there are genuine, you know, sort of we call them military concerns, but certainly
I think I put out
espionage concerns.
Yeah, the Chinese agreed to increase military spending by 7.2%, I think I put out a note called I can't even say it, Thucydides trap. Which is this sort of rising, the sort of inevitable march of the rising power meeting the established power, and the established power basically leading to war.
Okay.
So that's it, you know, so the US, Britain and Germany, First World War, Sparta and Athens back in the day.
You studied your military history a bit more than I have. But no, absolutely. It does, you know, it does have that feeling too. It doesn't feel like it's imminent.
But
certainly this is part of a concern, and you know, again, this affects sort of Chinese markets, Chinese companies, that you are seeing Western leaders, you know, becoming more and more nervous around China. I mean, you go back to sort of the Cameron Osborne era, you know, they were down the local pub having a pint.
That's near me, actually.
No more.
It's near Checkers, you know. Isn't it?
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah.
I'm sure it's a lovely pub. But, you know, you've seen it, Huawei, for example, the Chinese telecoms equipment company, basically stripped out of, you know, the UK network.
Yeah.
UK telecoms networks. Chinese, you know, technology was behind a lot of the sort of nuclear infrastructure that's going to be built in this country. And I'm not sure, you know, how viable that is anymore, given some of these security concerns.
Yeah. So I guess if we just come back to the original question, because I think we're probably running out of time, but is China the next Japan? To an extent, possibly. There's some things that are worse than it was for Japan, some things that maybe they've got the policy levers that maybe Japan didn't have. But the one thing that is the same is this demographic shift, and that's where ultimately, that's where the future lies, in the demographics. And there's certainly a lot of parallels.
Yeah, I mean, Japan is a very conservative culture, you know, so it's somewhere where it took a long time to change. That change is happening.
Yeah.
You know, China, you know, inherently conservative because of communism, but it's actually quite an entrepreneurial place.
Yeah.
And actually, as growth slows, what you might see is that, you know, political instability there becomes the issue to worry about. And then you've got India, of course, which you know has both demography on its side.
Yeah.
And you know the potential to really you know grow its sort of skilled workforce and attract Western companies. But the one thing I would say is, if you're an investor, the Chinese stock market is a lot cheaper than the Indian one.
Yeah, a lot cheaper than the Japanese one as well.
So there is a value component to think about from investment, as there always is.
As there always is. Well, on that note, I think that's a good note to finish on. So thank you very much, John. And thanks for listening to Overleveraged. And we'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Neil.
Remember, all opinions, news, research, analysis, prices, or other information is provided as general market commentary, not as investment advice, and all potential results discussed are not guaranteed to be achieved. The information may have been derived from publicly available sources, company reports, personal research, or surveys. Past performance is not indicative of future performance. Trading carries risk of capital loss, and the service is available to professional clients only.